Welcome to the Future of Pharma with ISP Boston, where I talk to the thought leaders of the pharmaceutical industry about where our industry is headed and what you can do about it. I'm your host, Samir Gondalia. Thanks for joining us today.
My guest today is Francesca McBride. Francesca completed a Bachelor of Science degree at the University of Delaware in 1985, majoring in pre-veterinary science. As a pharmaceutical biotechnology regulatory compliance specialist, Francesca works with international companies to support the design, startup, licensing, and operation of clinical and commercial product manufacturing facilities. She has been with Jacobs for 25 plus years, and currently in her capacity as a director of regulatory compliance, is involved in the support of client and design teams to ensure the design meets the applicable international CGMP, CGTP requirements. During her tenure at Jacobs, she has lived and worked in the United States, United Kingdom, Ireland, and India. She has both presented and published papers at global conferences. Most recently, she has worked with hospitals and universities in the design and startup of new cell therapy facilities that support the treatment of cancer. Francesca's goal is to build a stronger relationship with the cell therapy facilities to advance the cancer treatment opportunities, an area which is very close to her heart, and you'll understand why after listening to her story. Last but not least, she's also a triathlete. Enjoy this interview with Francesca and listen how she simplifies the complicated global regulations around the life sciences industry for us to understand. Here's Francesca McBride. Good morning, Francesca. Thank you for joining us today. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. Like many, adjusting to the very cold weather all of a sudden.
We're going to have to get used to it, for next few months. I saw your name at ISP Fall Educational Summit. You talked about the risk-based approach. But before we get into the technical nitty-gritties of your expertise, walk us through your career journey and some of the big, beautiful, awesome healthcare and capital projects you've been part of.
Well, I live in Wilmington, Delaware, and I got started long time ago, working for the DuPont company in their diagnostics division and in chemical toxicology research laboratories, and was doing that back in the 80s. And then when I worked for DuPont at the diagnostics, one of the things that DuPont did was come out with the early diagnostics for HIV, as the new disease that it was developing then. You develop a laboratory in order to be able to make the HIV virus and create the diagnostics for it. So certainly the different types of controls and information that we learned in that was very critical. Several of the folks that got to know from doing that left DuPont and started a consulting company and then invited me to come on board and join them in this. And that's when I moved into that company. That's when I started working in regulatory compliance. That was day one. That was my responsibility in helping to look at what were those requirements for the different types of processes and facilities and locations that we were working for, GMPs, biosafe, and even dealing with some of the animal facilities, and so animal vaccines, USDA here in the U.S. And working on various research labs and spaces in the early days, and then moving more into manufacturing as the focus was moving more towards the manufacture of some of these either diagnostics or in the cases there were different drugs that we were working with. And then in March of, I think the year 90, or sorry, in beginning of 91, Jacobs Engineering bought the company that I was working for. It was Triad Technologies, where I started at. And so moving into a large engineering construction company, and then continue to evolve and do the different things. And with their growth, took an assignment over in the UK for about a year and a half to help introduce the pharma bio work that we were doing in regulatory compliance into the operations and offices that Jacobs had in the UK, and then working at that time, we did have operations in Ireland. came back and continued to do different projects. And some of the things that I also was working in was also in the area of validation, certainly as closely tied as regulatory compliance and validation, quality systems, startup, things like that. So would take on sometimes the leadership of that. And at Jacobs, I moved from just being responsible for regulatory compliance, but also for a period directly responsible for oversight of our validation organization. And then, you know, progress different types of projects, a lot of biotechnology, monoclonal antibodies, vaccine projects. We certainly also did solid dosage drugs, those different types. And then I took another transfer for a big project we were doing. At that time, it was Wyeth, now Pfizer. But
not the one in Andover, was it?
No, that was certainly that we did work up in Andover for that. But this was for a new facility. It was called the Grange Castle.
Yeah, Ireland. Yeah. Because the reason I mentioned that was because I was working on the Andover project in Wyeth, and Jacobs was obviously our primary EPCMV. So that's why I mentioned, like, oh, wow, we both probably worked on the same project. And when they were building Grange Castle in Ireland, I did end up doing some work, not actually work on the project. But I worked for Pfizer for, you know, about 20 years, and then Pfizer bought over Wyeth. So, wow, this is very, we do have some overlap of the career projects.
I think that's one thing we find in this industry is,
you know, right,
us people that maybe you don't necessarily know directly, but you find that, you know, there is that connection through different projects. So when I went over to Grange Castle and I took on responsibility, you know, I had responsibility for regulatory compliance and the Jacobs overall validation of the different, you know, operate utilities and facilities and things like that. And then I took on a leadership role with the project in helping with the startup and qualification of the QC lab. Was there. So we were there for 2 years, loved it, came back and then, you know, moving into, you know, again, more projects is growing. And then did a project over in India. Jacobs was doing a pneumoconjugation facility at a contract manufacturing organization. And I was asked to come over there to help with the closeout of the validation. Then I was asked to stay on and help take them through the environmental startup of the facility for the vaccine. So I was there for about 7 or 8 months in India and then back again. And after coming back from that project, which was about 2007, that's when I started working in doing projects in the cell therapy.
Okay.
Started, first one I did was with the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute up in Boston, and then have been since that point just doing much, much more work in cell and gene therapy at a clinical level and now at certainly a commercial level. And throughout this, because both of Jacob's offices are around the world, I worked with our Singapore, India, U.S., European, Australian operations and done project deliveries for these and looking at the global regulatory compliance responsibilities and activities and needs that we have to address.
One thing that occurred to me that you have worked on the projects and technologies that were considered state of the art. So, for example, the Grange Castle project in Ireland, that was the biggest of its kind at the time, end to end, right? The cell therapy in 2008 was the new shiny thing. So you have had chance to work on, you know, latest and biggest thing of the time. Any new and exciting projects you are working on right now, like exosomes, or you have articles out there about the challenges in cell therapy facility. So that must be very exciting.
Oh, well, I very much enjoy the opportunity to work in the cell therapy and in the gene therapy. When you think, you know, as important as all the drugs and vaccines that are manufactured around the world are to the population of patients is great. But one of the things when I started doing the work with the cell therapy at the Dana-Farber facility is I actually got to see firsthand patients would be receiving the treatments from these. And that, I'll tell you, you know, you just need to get that kind of a glimpse, and it brings the value and importance of those projects so much more to the surface when you do that. because you're seeing firsthand that, not that it takes away anything from the other drugs that are out there, but you may never know who's receiving and benefiting by those drugs. Whereas here in these facilities, I got to see it firsthand, which brought it all that much more. And as well, they are continuously developing and changing, and new opportunities, new equipment, new processes, utilization of different types of cells for that processing is out there. And certainly one of the things that I have learned over the last, you know, let's just say, you know, 7-8 years, because I have had the opportunity for multiple of these projects to be engaged with the FDA Type C meetings, where the companies have presented them to the FDA, is you realize that even it's not just industry that is learning and developing, but even the regulatory agencies are learning.
People think that FDA regulations are written in stone in 30s, they don't change. What they don't realize is that they do, it's an evolving state of organism where new technology comes in, and FDA is very adaptable and very encouraging too. You know, it's not very common knowledge.
When that's the case, is as a company, you have to realize, because this is new technology, you have to be prepared to present your information and your data maybe in a bit more, let's just say, powerful way, so that it helps to ensure that you address whatever risks or concerns that they may be thinking about, because they're still thinking about this as research.
Right.
One of the things that's come out in my role in regulatory compliance over the years, I've been doing more and more work in quality risk assessments. That's the reason for that presentation this past fall. But in these areas, the FDA is looking, and the EMA as well, for the early implementation or execution of a quality risk assessment to look at the risk of cross-contamination, product contamination, mix-ups, and things like that. And have you addressed those throughout the facility? And previously, I would have said that this is the kind of thing that we only were doing so much for maybe late stage clinical or commercial manufacturing. But actually now, and I know this firsthand from projects, they're wanting us to do it at phase 1, phase 2 clinicals as well to ensure the same types of controls have definitely been considered and are being applied.
So that brings me, actually, I should have asked this question to begin with. Regulatory is in news a lot more lately because of COVID-19 vaccines, right? Any article you open, there is some mention of regulatory. And for the most people who read news, regulatory, they understand it, but not really. It's like Shakespeare. It sounds good, but nobody really understands it. So how would you explain, like, what is regulatory? If someone asked you at a dinner party with not much background in the pharma sector, how do you explain what regulatory is, and how do you and the pharmaceutical companies interpret FDA regulations?
So the regulations are written and focus on the overall need to ensure safety, efficacy, and quality of the different drug products that are being manufactured. And in order to do that, obviously, the guidance and definition of those requirements starts even at a research level, just because it's helping to convey to the organization what type of data do they need to collect. How, from a control standpoint, do they have it? They may not go through full validation or anything like that. It's not a requirement. But at the same time, they still need to be thinking about the data and the collection and the testing that they're doing, because they're going to, at the point that they get to it, submit that to the regulatory agency in order to get permission to go forward into human clinical trials.
So before we go, because that's actually, that's one of the fascinating things. How do they tell you? They don't tell you collect this data, right? They give you guidelines that, oh, you need to prove this. So what does FDA say, and how do different companies, or, you know, an SME such as yourself, interpret that to tell your clients that, hey, guys, you need data for, I don't know, SEC appearance, da, 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 and all that?
So the FDA has, and you can go on their website, and you can find an extensive database of guidelines and procedures and documented, you know, even presentations and things like that, that are there and available for anyone to be able to go in and see. And certainly as well, you have the GMPs, which in federal code of
CFRs.
CFR, right, Code of Federal Regulations, and then the Federal Register. So you start there, and what's written in those documents are often, let's just say, specific and high level, not kind of the detail that you get in a guideline, in a guidance document, which goes into more expansive explanation and understanding. And so depending on the type of product and the stage of operations and things like that, type of product, type of processes, stage of manufacturing relative to early phase clinical, late phase clinical, product launch, full scale manufacturing, different ones apply, and the detail and what needs to be done. And so, the FDA is there to, make that information available. And then the companies, of course, as they are developing an organization, need to take that data on and then look at it, review it, and be able to develop their own internal quality standards and systems such that they can move forward with all of those necessary controls. And so, you know, all the pharmaceutical companies that have been out there for some time have a well-established program, quality systems that focus on things from operation and maintenance to manufacturing, different process steps, quality control laboratories, licensing product, response to incidents that occur, failures, you know, failure data, things like that. And so there's all those different procedures that have to be put in place. And certainly in an early phase of a design, let's just say, you know, we want to put in place a new facility for, let's just say, cell therapy or gene therapy project. And this is a new company. And so this is, you know, during, let's just say, the first phase of the design, you go through and you develop that design and understanding and the focus of what's in the facility. Maybe during the second phase of design, consideration you give to presenting it to the regulatory agencies. And here in the FDA, or in the U.S., that's called a Type C meeting, where you have the opportunity to put together a package, submit it for FDA review, and then you get their feedback and you can have a review meeting. So that way you can confirm, is the design on board and are we good to go, or are there changes that we need to consider making, or maybe they may even identify some additional things that you want to be looking to do. But that helps with that early phase. You get that feedback during the design. You can be responsive and have a level of assurance, confidence that you're moving, you know, forward in that right direction, making those decisions. Because certainly, the regulations do change. Either new ones come out that haven't been in existence before, or there's an update to existing standards. Like Annex 1 in Europe is in revision, and it's been over several years, but due to the expansion of the update and then commentary that they've gotten back from different groups, it's taking them longer to get that through the final review and approval process.
Okay.
And that occurs. But at least from an industry standpoint, we're able to stay connected so you can see what's going on and understand that. And at times, for myself, because I've developed over the many years, a relationship with some of the people within the FDA, as it is maybe necessary or beneficial, I'll actually reach out and ask questions directly. And on a client behalf, I don't necessarily need to say who I'm doing this for. I just, you know, will ask the question to get enough of direction, clarification on what would be the expectation as they step forward. And so that's been very beneficial. And I've been able to do that as well with the EMA, different, you know, regulatory agencies around the world. Do that with the NIH CDC on behalf of biosafety as it's been applicable for processing. Because, you know, all of these different things apply relative to the control, the consideration that you have to do with the design.
Right. Have you seen any difference in the approach you just mentioned over the years? So, for example, everything around us has changed. Technology has changed, right? The way we live has changed over the last, say, 20 to 30 years. Have you seen any difference in the approach of FDA or regulatory agencies, how they regulate things? Like, you know, they used to ask for XYZ, now they ask for X, Y, and A. Or has it become more efficient? Any changes? And where do you think we are going in next few years in if we say this is going to get better and more efficient?
I think that probably the biggest change that has occurred over, you know, the last, you know, number of years is, and I think this is an extremely beneficial thing, is that because of organizations like PICS, Pharmaceutical Inspection Convention, there's been a greater or more increased alignment among different agencies around the world because they are becoming members of the PICS organization. They're aligning when they do become members of the PICS regulations. PICS.
What do you say? What does it stand for? Pharmaceutical?
Pharmaceutical Inspection Convention.
And does it have anything to do with ICH?
Well, they do look at ICH. That's tied into.
Okay, I thought so. Right.
Country agencies, you know, and I'm talking about regulatory agencies.
Like EMEA and FDA.
Exactly. And say, yes, we're buying into this. And then they participate in that program. It works to help get them more aligned. They're engaged in inspections in a different way. And I say that because they're partnering for some of this when they're looking at getting PICS applications. So I think that's been a tremendously valuable methodology in transition because it's helping to not only align the agencies, but also bring a more focused way that we can look at what are those requirements in a common way. Certainly, like in the U.S., we apply from a environmental classification, ISO 5, ISO 7, ISO 8, you know, ISO 9. European, they use grade A, B, C, D. But if you look at their standard, they've now changed. So it's now you can see, well, grade A is ISO 5 at rest and in operation. Grade 7, or grade B is ISO 5 at rest, ISO 7 in operation. And so it's see where those commonalities are coming. And so it makes it easier to understand what the expectations. And it also, in many ways, has helped the company so that when they are looking, how do we design our facility, if our market is going to be this or that for the product, then, well, we're just going to do international markets. So let's look at PICS. Let's look, you know, and then, you know, some of these other supplemental requirements that might apply.
That's a wonderful idea. That sounds like, you know, if you get an international patent from Geneva, you don't have to file for patents in individual countries. And it's good for the agencies. It's good for pharmaceutical companies. It's good for patients because the pharmaceutical companies will invest more resources to make sure that they meet various requirements across the board and the medicine can get to market sooner. We are talking about international agencies. Now, in cases where the companies don't follow PICS or ICH and they have to get approval from different agencies like FDA, EMEA, or, you know, Japan. What are the subtle differences you see?
Sorry.
Oh, don't worry. I have a dog too.
Somebody must have come to my house and caused the dogs to get excited. Sorry about that.
No, that's okay. Is that a German Shepherd?
No, I have two chocolate labs.
Well, they are just as guard dog. We have a German Shepherd, so when anything that's moving walk by our house, she starts protecting us from that moving thing. So, yeah, that's okay. Don't worry about it. People know this is a house with a dog, or in your case, dogs.
Just as a clarification around license, PICS as an organization is out there to work on the alignment across industry of the different regulatory agencies and doing that with standards and things like that. But at the same time, if company wants to get a license. Let's say here in the U.S., company A wants to manufacture this solid oral dosage drug here in the U.S. and their market is going to be Japan. And they still have to submit their application for licensing to those specific countries. You don't submit it to PICS.
Okay. You just follow their, you follow their standards.
Right. So they've got the standards, and PICS as a group may support, they may, let's just say, if it is Japan, that's the market, or the facilities in the US and Japan and Europe. So you may get the inspection might involve an FDA person. It might involve somebody from the EMA and somebody from Japan may participate in the inspection and work together with that data. But you as a company still submit the drug application to the agency directly.
But if you are, if you've been following PICS standards, you can take the comfort that you are more likely to pass very multiple agencies inspection and don't have to worry. Right. Okay. So that's the whole point. So my question was that what are the different perspective or subtle differences you have observed between various international regulatory agencies like FDA, EMEA, they both are trying to do the same thing, right? Safe, efficacious, quality products. But where do they differ?
I think that one area where, let's just say FDA and EMA differ is you certainly, in many cases, see more detail in some of the standards that the EMA has published, you know, Annex 1, Annex 2, Annex 3, you know, all of those have come out. Those can be spread out in a number of different guidelines that the FDA has done. So that's one thing.
Does it mean more data or a different way to do, let's say, you know, virus clearance or impurity clearance or?
No, it doesn't necessarily mean that. It just means that if, let's just say you were maybe new and trying to figure this out, you might have to look in a couple of different locations to get that
clarification.
Just in terms of where that is. So that's one thing. I think, certainly, just organizationally within the FDA, you know, you have the different groups, the biologics organization, drug organization, the diagnostics devices, that kind of thing. And so depending on what type of product you're dealing with, then you're going to deal with a different group within that in the FDA. And again, they're still looking at GMP and, you know, there's a section 210, 211, which are the general GMPs. There's 600 for biologics, and then you get into 606, the vaccines and blood processing and things like that, and then 800s for medical devices, things like that. And so they're different. Similar to that, you have different annexes within the EMA for those, but it's, and so that's part of it. And I have found that my ability to interface with the FDA relative to even just asking questions and getting guidance and things like that is a little bit easier for me here in the U.S. just, you know, whether it's because, you know, CBER is just down in the Maryland area, you know, can connect in with them in a more easy way than it is necessary to call the EMA in Europe. And obviously with some of the change, you know, and maybe it's more beneficial to go directly to the local country and talk with them as a regulator. So it's just a matter of understanding where is the best contact to make. Certainly on the drug side here in the U.S., you have not only CDER in the Maryland, you know, where the FDA is, but then they also have offices throughout the U.S., whereas the CBER organization is really pretty much based in the Maryland area or a couple of other locations, as opposed to having local offices, let's just say in Philadelphia, Boston, things like that. So it's just a matter of knowing and understanding that. And so I think that that's the kind of thing that I do find helpful. But I think that relative to the standards, there are some differences between them, such as high purity water systems and what are the requirements for what's acceptable. You know, the FDA has had, you know, a broad, you know, acceptance for high purity water system, whereas now the EMA has moved in the direction that you can do it, but not all countries in Europe are necessarily on board with that. And so I think it's important to understand some of those kind of differences. In the same way, be it in Brazil, where, you know, you're dealing with Anvisa and what are the expectations down there or differences even with Japan, because some of the different country agency have some specifics that are important to understand. And this is why in my role, it's necessary for me to, as much as I can, stay on board with what's the evolution that's going forward in the regulations and download them so that I can know what might be those changes that are going to be differences relative to consideration.
It seems that for the most part, how you do operations on a day-to-day basis, that is not impacted mostly, but how you present the data and your applications to the agency, that might be different or what they want to show, what they want to see in which package. You mentioned that you work on, you know, capital projects and startups and as well. What are, as far as the regulatory is concerned, we are talking about you do something today, but you file the application 5-10 years down the road. At the beginning of the project, what are some do's and don'ts that you have observed which might pay big dividends or you might have to pay a big price towards later? Something you do in the at the beginning of project that you people overlook, but comes to haunt you when it's time to submit the application.
So I think that some of the key things that, you know, we try and make sure that there's alignment up front on what are the process operations that are going and the support operations that are going to be performed in the facility. And let's go through and make sure they're well defined and understood. That doesn't mean you necessarily have every procedure written and that kind of thing right up front, but it's important to understand those. And then make sure, okay, what are the locations where we are going to consider marketing the product? So is it going to be international? Therefore, we want to look at all the different regulations, or is it going to be country specific?
Okay. So begin with the end in mind. Where do you want to, which market do you want to reach, and what do you want to do now?
Drive the design of the facility. It obviously is going to have some impact into, depending on at what stage you're in, let's say the clinical trial and even the focus that, you know, the company is thinking about that, the process operations that are going to occur. And, you know, and then, you know, things like in the case of some of these different technologies like cell therapy, where initially much of this started within the hospitals and medical schools because of the development and closeness they are with the patient. And they're receiving in patient cells directly into the facility, and then they do the processing of them and then get them back to the patients for readministration to that. And so then part of what has to be thought about is now that we're moving to manufacturing organizations doing this, what's the adjacencies that they need to have to the locations where the patients are, so that
So you had
do that, you know. For the good news is, when I certainly first started working on this, most of the cell therapies could not be, they had to be delivered as referred to as fresh to the patient. So they finished manufacturing and they went straight over to the patient. Within 60 minutes from finish, you had to actually give it to the patient via leukapheresis. Right away.
But in that case, the patients were in the building, right? That's how we got to meet them.
Yeah, or right next door kind of thing.
Right, right next door.
Now
right.
They do cryopreservation, so they do a, you know, cryo-freezing of that, and then they transfer them in these special devices, like we're hearing with the corona vaccine, you know. Of
I was just going to mention that.
How they have to be transferred from manufacturing to the location and kept frozen until they're ready to give to the people. And so it's a very important thing. And those are the kinds of things we need to take in consideration early on so that you can design for those capabilities to support that in the facility. Looking at, are you going to have a 100% startup all at once, or is it going to be maybe a phased startup? And then in that case, how do you manage that so that it doesn't interfere with the ongoing manufacturing? Because especially in the area of, let's just say, cell processing, we're finding that these facilities are truly operating 24/7 so that they can handle as many patient products and get it back to them. And so a disruption is critical relative to the way they. So those are things that we're having to think about day one of the project so that they can be appropriately addressed. And then, of course, what is that startup strategy going to be for a new organization that has to put procedures in place, do the training of their operators, when do they bring them on board, and get them into that manufacturing operation. And, yeah, because some of what I get involved with, you know, at Jacobs is helping in the development of those quality systems and identifying what they are that are needed, and then helping to put together the actual standards, the SOPs for gowning, for environmental monitoring, for control of documents, you know, change management, things like that. You know, so just the
right things.
Because all of that needs to be in place for, you know, the time when you're going to start to manufacture, be it for clinical or for commercial manufacturing and licensing of the facility.
When I'm listening to you, it seems that all of these things are common sense. You start the facility, you should think of these things. But I totally understand that when you are starting a facility, you are starting a company, so whether it's a startup or a capital project worth, you know, $300 million, your priorities are totally different. Your focus is, you know, at other things which might require your attention, and these kind of things might be very easy to overlook, and or at least think that, oh, they are not time sensitive, we can deal with it later. But you mentioned about COVID vaccine, and I do want to point out that to Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna, and now AstraZeneca, to their credit, they started talking about supply chain in summer when they got the earlier stability data, and, you know, started talking about that this is going to be a challenge, we are going to ship this frozen, and we need to figure it out. So come December, now it's not a limiting factor. It's slow, but we can steadily move forward with the distribution because they already thought about the supply chain potential issues in the beginning.
And there are more companies that are working in the development of the vaccine as well as in the construction and startup of those facilities. Because
right. Absolutely.
Several projects, that is not one that is out there, you know, Pfizer, AstraZeneca. So there are additional companies that are doing that. And that's good news, because when we think about having to get this product to a global population, that's a lot of people.
You're absolutely right. Even at the full capacity, it's going to be very, very difficult to reach everyone who wants to take a vaccine. So more options, the better. It will give us more flexibility. Now let's slightly change the gears and, you know, talk about personal development. We talked about professional development and your expertise in regulatory field. What advice would you give to young women starting in healthcare or engineering companies such as yourself about how to succeed in this field?
One of the things I'll say is when I went to college, I didn't even know about, I mean, I certainly knew about vaccines and drugs and things like that because myself as a patient, but I didn't even know about the overall process. It was not something that when I was in college could study and learn about. The advantage is today there's so much more knowledge and information, and so I think that the college age students can start to investigate and look at this and be able to give consideration to multiple aspects of things that they may want to consider for their career. Be it, is it in an engineering and design? Is it in a process development? Is it in support of clinical trials, you know? Be it hospital or medical school, whatever, you know, they're being done. Is it a regulatory compliance and quality assurance? So there are many different avenues of which one can consider. And I think part of the selection process, and this is somewhat of, is how do you feel as an individual? Are you the type of person who wants to be a leader, you know, and you say a manager? Are you more of a technical person who wants to focus on how do we support from a technical and establishment in that? And that I think is key to think about. And then when I got started in this work after graduate, I was married and my oldest daughter at that time was just 3 years old. And so with that came the need, you know, the job I took, travel, and how do you whole managed do about that? And that's the kind of thing to just be thinking about. And, you know, I was very lucky. My husband had a job that was local. And so if he was traveling from Wilmington, maybe he went to Philadelphia or maybe he went downstate. But he wasn't overnight at places and things. And so that enabled yep. me to
right.
be
able to. He didn't go to Ireland or India.
Right. Exactly. It's just an important kind of thing to take into consideration because not everybody is up for that.
Right.
But
yeah.
if that is something, then do that. And then I think as I started to get into this work and you know, starting out the DuPont company, we had big offices and operations and men, women in different roles and responsibilities, it gave me a chance to see what some of these different things are. And so as I started to work in the engineering organization and in my role of regulatory, this provided me an opportunity to say, now, what is it that I need to focus on such that I can further develop my expertise? And in the case of the Grange Castle project, when mm-hmm. that one came up and, you know, consideration, who is the team that we're going to move over to Ireland for this project? Talked with my husband, and then the next thing, you know, I did is I thought about the partner. I said, well, if I go over to Ireland and do this leadership role in regulatory validation, I'm going to have a chance to be very engaged with construction because of the different things that we do. And so that is an opportunity for me to learn about that delivery from a startup in construction. And that transition for our life. So I took that as a key driver for me to want to do that and then focus on it. When we were doing a project for Sanofi, this was for a flu vaccine in the mm-hmm. Poconos. This was, again, a different process, but it was also a heavily automated process. And I thought, you know what? I need to learn more about the delivery of automation. So this was one of the reasons why, for me, I took asked to take that leadership role in that. And luckily I was given that opportunity. And so I think that it's valuable and important to constantly be thinking about where do I need further development? What role can I play that's going to give me that increased focus on different projects and then to see am I in a position to take advantage of that. And a lot of times you just have to ask.
Yeah. And it's surprising. And I'll supplement one more thing to what you said earlier. As you said about asking, it's if you raise your hand to do something, to volunteer on a project, most likely you'll get it. If you volunteer for something, people, you cannot get more authority, but you can always get more responsibility if you raise your hand. But I do want to add one more thing to what you said earlier about find out what you want, do your research. Right now, it's much easier. It's the internet has democratized the knowledge and information, right? So something that you can learn after 6 months on a job, you can learn by looking at YouTube videos and reading blog articles over a weekend. So you know that the job that you want, what kind of job it will be. So doing research is so much easier now. We talked about your career. We talked about what young women can learn from your career in an engineering firm. When you were growing up, did you have any role models, you know, someone you looked up to, real or historical or fictional, who helped you shape your worldview or career choices?
Well, when I was growing up from a big family and the thing that I thought about, you know, when I wanted to go to, was starting to think about college is what do I want to study such that my undergraduate is actually animal science / pre-vet.
Yeah, University of Delaware, right?
Yep, I went to the University of Delaware. And I had worked prior to, you know, when I was in high school in different animal facilities, the local zoo I worked in, and I worked at a dog kennel in different places like that. And so I just knew because of this kind of thing that that's what I wanted to study. And when I went to the University of Delaware, my freshman teacher, that I had in animal science, Dr. Samowitz. He was just such a wonderful guidance mm-hmm. individual, helping you to understand what you were going to be studying and answering questions, and it really became a role model for me to be thinking about, you know, don't narrow your window of consideration. Keep it wide. Think about these different things and, you know, take the step to reach out and find me. I actually spent a summer between my sophomore and junior year in Kenya on a project through organization that was interfaced with Harvard for the study of the black rhino.
Okay. And, oh, wow.
And again, I considered this opportunity because I was waiting to talk to Dr. Samowitz at school, and I saw this, and then I had some follow-up discussion with him. And I was like, you know what? This is something I'm interested in. And then I talked to my dad, and he was like, let's do it. Yeah. And I think it was that kind of strategy, if you will, in terms of just making me keep my mind open and thinking, that really helped. And then over the years, I got the chance to work with, you know, many different people that continue to provide that stimulus to me.
Any books that you recommend to others, or any books that you keep going back over and over again every year or every few years?
Well, certainly I do find that I go back to the old chemistry books, or, you know, some of the stuff that I'm learning about this, but there are
something light.
Yeah. Something like, well, I think that there is a book that my older sister gave to me, and it's called The Red Tent. And it just is a book that talks about women and the role, and this is back in Israel, you know, generations and generations ago, and the development and the importance of a group of women. And I read that, I think in, you know, my early 30s, my sister shared it with me, and I have read that book 4 or 5 times since, because it's just every so often I need to go back and remind myself in that thinking of that way. Very, you know, a novel, but very good.
What's the name of the book?
The Red Tent.
The last question. If you have to, do you have a choice of a topic to do a potential TED Talk? If you have to do a TED Talk other than outside of your subject matter expertise, something you're passionate about, something you are really knowledgeable, but not your profession.
So the one thing that I have learned in working with the cell therapy and the gene therapy is about the valuableness that it brings to people and helps individuals and families and so forth. Not to want to necessarily bring up a sad note, but 2 years ago, my husband passed from cancer, and he was somebody who was going through clinical trials and, you know, some of this with the early phase cell therapy. He didn't survive, but it gave me that chance to see about the valuableness that these medications bring. And so, I think that for me, the kind of thing that I'm actually starting to try and investigate is how do I get to share more of that personal knowledge with the technical knowledge so that we can bring that benefit to more people. And that benefit is not only the delivery of the medicines, but also the delivery of that incentive to help those people as to why they want to make these things come out and be there for people. Because so much of success is around that type of enthusiasm and energy and drive.
You should definitely continue to work on this talk, Francesca, because this can be really heartwarming and inspirational talk, exactly something what TED people are looking for. And I really hope that I will come across your speech in a few years. Before we say goodbye to our audience, do you have any last parting words, questions, or ask?
Well, I think a couple of things. One, be it men or women, I think, as you had brought up, that obviously today the ability to investigate or research lots of this information is so much easier than it, you know, certainly when I first started, you had to go to the library, whereas in this case, that library is on the computer. And so there's many ways that you can just even investigate to find out what are some of the options and considerations that, you know, one should do. And the other thing that I have learned is, be it professionals out there, be it, let's just say, even myself, I'm here to answer questions for people. And so please don't feel that you can't reach out to those people that may be more knowledgeable when you might have a simple question that you just need to get some direction. And be it an FDA person, be it a somebody who's with the ISPE, you know, or the PDA and has been there a long time, you can look in there and say, oh, look, there's a regulatory professional. Let me just ask them the question. And maybe that puts you in that right connection to do that. And I think that we've got to stay open-minded about that. And that's the kind of thing that helps people to grow and really develop. And I think that's just so important.
Now, how does one get in touch with you? Someone has more questions about regulator, as you mentioned. Someone wants to reach out to you. Email, LinkedIn, what's your choice of?
Email would be the best way, my Jacobs email. So francesca.mcbride@jacobs.com. So it's Francesca, FRANCESCA@jacobs.com.
Francesca, thank you so very much for your time and generosity and sharing your knowledge with us. Really, really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for considering to bring me forward in this. It's also been a delight for myself as well.
Hope you enjoyed today's episode. Be sure to subscribe and let others know word of mouth is our oxygen. Visit www.ispeboston.org for the comprehensive show notes from today's episode and also find out more ways to associate with us. Do let us know your thoughts in the comment section, and if there is someone you'd like to see as a guest on the show, thanks again for joining us today. We'll see you next time.